The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share with you information from various medical sources. The People's Pharmacy is curcumin a waste of time and money? Question. You occasionally receive letters about the alleged benefits of turmeric and its active ingredient, curcumin. There is a lot of nonsense out there about turmeric, and lots of money is being made selling it to gullible people. Attached is a link to a paper in the Journal of Medicinal Chemistry. It is an exhaustive review of curcumin studies that, in summary, finds no benefit at all to curcumin use. I suggest you read it and broadcast these findings in your column. The supplement industry is a mess, and you do some good by relying on data. This makes you a rarity. Answer. We found the article you sent fascinating from the Journal of Medicinal Chemistry, January 11, 2017. The authors conclude that curcumin is not a promising compound to be developed into a drug. That is partly because it is chemically unstable and poorly absorbed. They contrast these properties to those of drugs developed from other natural products, such as the cancer drug Taxol from the Pacific Yew, or the malaria drug Artemisinin from Artemisia. The suggestion that scientists are wasting their time on curcumin or turmeric might be premature, however. Turmeric is a plant that contains a wide range of active compounds in addition to curcumin. Some animal studies appear promising, such as one demonstrating that turmeric oils added to curcumin ease the inflammation of experimentally induced colitis. And that's cited in Scientific Reports, April 11, 2017. A meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials in people with ulcerative colitis concluded cautiously that curcumin might be able to maintain remission. That's in the ACTA Medica Indonesiana, October 2017. A recent placebo-controlled trial suggests that curcumin slows bone loss in people with spinal cord injury, and that's cited in World Neurosurgery, March 19, 2018. Trying to turn turmeric into a drug might be challenging. Perhaps people should try adding it to their food instead, as people in India have been doing for thousands of years. Calcium for bones led to agonizing constipation. Question. Even the smallest amount of calcium supplement causes me severe constipation. Recently, my doctor told me that I should take calcium for osteoporosis prevention. Although I explained that it causes constipation, she insisted, so I tried it again. I thought I would have to go to the emergency room. I was so backed up that I had to use milk of magnesia and enemas to get myself unblocked. I threw out my bottle of calcium and will not take it again. How else can I get the calcium I need without suffering? Answer. The idea that calcium supplements are effective for preventing osteoporosis and fractures is controversial. One review of 33 controlled studies found that the use of supplements that included calcium, vitamin D, or both, compared with placebo or no treatment, was not associated with a lower risk of fractures. And that's in JAMA, December 26, 2017. You could get the calcium you need from food. Milk is a rich source, and so are yogurt, kefir, and mozzarella cheese. If dairy products are not for you, try dark green vegetables like kale, collards, turnip greens, and bok choy. Tofu, almonds, sesame seeds, beans, canned salmon, and sardines are other good sources of calcium that should not cause constipation. Question. I developed peripheral neuropathy 2 years ago. I suffered until a neurologist prescribed Lyrica twice a day. Although it has helped my symptoms, I have gained 25 pounds in the past 6 months. The increase in appetite is very difficult to control. I even wake up at night with hunger pains. Is there anything to counteract this so I can lose the excess weight? Previously, I was in good health and walked briskly 2 miles a day. The neuropathy prevents that now. Answer. Some people are susceptible to significant weight gain while taking Lyrica. You might ask your doctor if there are other options for your nerve pain. Benfotiamine, a vitamin B derivative, might offer a different approach. And that's cited in PLOS 1, February 19, 2015. Question. I love grapefruit, the whole fruit. I used to eat it often, but I have gone without it for several years now. That is because I take simvastatin to lower my cholesterol. I discussed my cravings with my heart doctor, and we reached a happy medium. I can have half a grapefruit in the morning every 5 or 6 days. I take my pill in the evening, and he figures 12 hours or so is a safe time to spread between medication and fruit. Answer. Your doctor has it partially correct. Grapefruit contains compounds that inhibit a crucial enzyme in the digestive tract that breaks down many medications, including simvastatin. This means more medicine circulates in the body, increasing the risk for side effects. When grapefruit and simvastatin are taken together, blood levels of the drug increase by 260%. That's cited in the Medical Journal of Medicine, January 2016. When taken 12 hours apart, as your doctor recommends, blood levels go up by 90%. Enjoying grapefruit once or twice a week probably won't have a lasting effect. Daily grapefruit, however, could cause trouble since the grapefruit effect lasts at least 24 hours. To learn more about the interactions of grapefruit and other foods with medicines, you may wish to download our free guides to drug and food interactions and grapefruit interactions available at peoplespharmacy.com. This warning may cause severe anxiety. This is from the Wall Street Journal. Big Pharma has had many grand successes, from correcting erectile dysfunction to masking bald spots on the president's head. But its TV commercials are starting to make me sick. Across the dial, but especially on cable news, it's hard to avoid drug ads in which the dominant theme seems to be a risk of sudden death. Worse, if the prescription doesn't kill you, there's a chance you'll simply kill yourself. Consider Chantix, which calls itself the number one prescribed prescription quit smoking aid. Its commercials mention the usual side effects such as weight gain. Then, while happy-go-lucky background images roll, the announcer also warns of suicidal thoughts or actions. Talk about a dilemma. Die from smoking or kill yourself because you finally tried to quit. This raises many vexing questions. How serious does a malady have to be to risk suicide while curing it? Why are so many drugs prompting this anyway? And why are the dire TV warnings always accompanied by gorgeous, happy people gardening, dancing, or frolicking with cute dogs? It was roughly 25 years ago that the Food and Drug Administration opened the floodgates for product claim drug ads aimed at consumers. Now companies spend more than $5 billion a year on them. The FDA's rules say the ads must include a major statement of the drug's risks, and this presentation must be spoken. That has created lucrative gigs for voiceover announcers capable of mellifluously mentioning that, by the way, you might kill your cat or your neighbor, but don't let it distract you from this footage of Hawaiian sunsets. In 2003, I conducted an experiment on candid camera with a fictitious pill we called febloxylene. Our claim was that it strengthened fingernails, and we recruited a dozen or so college students to test the product. Before they began treatment, our fake announcer, using his best Hawaiian sunset voice, explained that side effects included uncontrolled flatulence, as well as decrease in weight or height. No one cared. Who pays attention to that sort of verbal fine print? A few years later, Kristen Wiig did a Chantix ad spoof on Saturday Night Live in which she was warned about a powerful, overwhelming desire to kill the person you love most. Other side effects, jazz hands and Robert De Niro face. Did I mention I've been taking a wonder drug for 10 years whose warning includes a risk of death? My doctor put me on Enbrel with a brief chat about risk, but no mention of mortality, which is why I left his office happy and confident. Now the nightly ads are stressing me out. The FDA wants to warn patients considering new drugs, overlooking the frightening effect on millions of people already taking them. Fact is, short-form TV ads are better suited to extol and get, say, Pepsi, than explaining the risks of powerful pharmaceuticals. Doctors complain they spend time fielding questions about TV warnings, and the American Medical Association has long lobbied against such ads. Perhaps the FDA should require a new warning about the side effects of too many drug commercials. And this is by Peter Funt, who is the son of Alan Funt. And Peter Funt is a writer and host of Candid Camera. From the Los Angeles Times, by Deborah Netburn. Scientists find signs of brain cell growth in older adults. Do we continue to add new neurons to our brain circuitry throughout our lives, or does our neuron count remain fixed once we reach adulthood? The scientific debate rages on. In a report published recently in Cell Stem Cell, scientists from Columbia University present new evidence that our brains continue to make hundreds of new neurons a day, even after we reach our 70s, in a process called neurogenesis. To come to this conclusion, lead author Dr. Maura Boldrini, a research scientist at Columbia University's Department of Psychiatry, and her colleagues looked at the brains of 28 deceased people ages 14 to 79. Their goal was to see whether aging affects neuron production. Previous research had shown that neurogenesis slows down in aging mice and non-human primates. Boldrini's group wanted to see whether a similar pattern occurred in humans. In each brain sample, the researchers looked for evidence of neurons in various stages of development, including stem cells, intermediate progenitor cells that would eventually become neurons, immature neurons that had not fully developed, and new neurons. The team looked only at the hippocampus, in part because it is one of the few areas of the brain that previous research has shown can produce new neurons into adulthood. This region is involved in emotional control and resiliency, as well as memory, Boldrini said. In all their samples, the researchers found similar numbers of neural progenitor cells and immature neurons, regardless of age. This led them to conclude that the human brain continues to make neurons even into old age. However, the researchers did uncover some differences in the brains of young people and older people. Specifically, they found that development of new blood vessels in the brain decreases progressively as people get older. They also discovered that a protein associated with helping new neurons to make connections in the brain decreased with age. We don't find fewer of the new neurons or fewer of the progenitors of new neurons, but we find that new neurons might make fewer connections, Boldrini said. This might explain why some older people suffer from memory loss or exhibit less emotional resiliency, she said. These new findings were published 1 month after a team of researchers from the University of California, San Francisco, reported in Nature that it was unable to find any evidence of neurogenesis after adolescence in humans at all. From Parade Magazine, Cheater's Guide to Beating Alzheimer's. Sometimes I walk into a room and can't remember why. I lose my keys, I blank on names, so I wonder, Could I be heading for Alzheimer's the way my dad and my grandmother did? Or is there a way I can beat such a fate? That's how I found myself in a New York City doctor's office one recent winter afternoon, playing computer card matching games and identifying smells like lemon and Play-Doh. These brain tests were part of my extensive workup at Weill Cornell Medicine's Alzheimer's Prevention Clinic, the first of its kind in the United States and one of only a handful of centers to focus on the emerging science of dementia and risk assessment and prevention strategies. I came in at a great time. Clinic founder Richard S. Isaacson, M.D., a neurologist, tells me, even 5 years ago, the idea that Alzheimer's was preventable was laughed at. In medical school, I was taught that dementia just starts one day, Isaacson said. Today, we know differently. Scientists now think a complex mix of lifestyle, genes, age, environment, and health conditions leads to the brain changes of Alzheimer's up to 20-25 years before obvious symptoms. That's another reason I came to the clinic at a good time. At age 57, I'm exactly 25 years younger than the average age of my relatives when their memory loss and odd behaviors first showed up. There's been a shift toward changing the progress of disease before symptoms occur. That's really exciting, says Maria C. Carrillo, Ph.D., Chief Science Officer of the Alzheimer's Association. Alzheimer's is finally joining the list of diseases we can have an early effect on, says Harvard neurologist Risa A. Sperling, M.D. She compares it to heart disease or diabetes, which are treated preventively with a mix of lifestyle fixes like diet and targeted medications like statins. The idea of treating Alzheimer's upstream, long before we fail to recognize family or forget what a phone is, was sparked by the ability to finally see and track the biomarkers showing early brain changes. Given that hundreds of drugs have been thrown at cases of full-blown disease only to wipe out during testing, starting further back makes sense. As with heart attacks, not everyone might be avoided. But what if you could delay the onset for 5 or 10 years, or until there was a cure? Predicting Alzheimer risks. At the Alzheimer's Prevention Clinic, I step on a large machine that looks like a cross between a fancy scale and a treadmill. As I stand still, it reads my body fat, lean body mass, muscle strength, and more. A clinician measures my waist and asks how it's changed since my 20s. Oops, 4 inches bigger. These body measures, or anthropometrics, represent the A in what the clinic calls the ABCs of Alzheimer's prevention. The B stands for blood biomarkers. Blood tests reveal nutritional, lipid, metabolic, inflammatory, and genetic markers of possible problems. Everything from my cholesterol numbers to whether I have one of the genes linked to Alzheimer's risk. And C stands for cognition, or thinking skills, measured by 1.5 hours of those brain tests. I also supplied an intensive health history about my diet, exercise, stress level, and more. Among the more curious questions, my high school rank, 18 of 650, because early achievement has been shown to be protective, and whether I dream, oh yes, a sign of good sleep. The goal, to assess threats and identify fixable issues known to affect brain health. You can't do much about some things that raise your risk of Alzheimer's, like your genes, gender, it's a higher risk for women, or age. About 1 in 3 adults get dementia by age 85. The odds are 50-50. The big opportunity lies in a modifiable risk factor. What you eat, how you sleep, blood pressure, overall fitness, even your waistline, abdominal fat raises your risk threefold. Genes are not your destiny, Isaacson says. The hot word is epigenetics, changing the expression of our genes by changing how we live. Fish and wine are A-OK. Reviewing my data, Isaacson grades me an A on my A's anthropometrics. They show 21.9% body fat, pretty darn good, if short of optimal. My wider waist is still okay, but a spot to watch. Though my legs are super strong, I walk or run every morning. My core strength is sad. I slouch at a desk all day. My blood work reveals a few surprises. I eat fish 2 to 3 times a week, but I'm low in DHA, EPA, and ALA omega-3 fatty acids linked to brain and heart health. I'm also low in vitamin D, and despite my clean and green diet, poorly absorb vitamin B vitamins. My triglycerides rock, though, so that wine isn't harming you, I'm told. Yay! At least my cognition scores are great. I don't think that extra inch in your waist is affecting your cognitive function, Isaacson tells me. We all lose keys and forget names due to normal aging, distraction, and stress. It's when mental slips interfere with everyday life that doctors get concerned. The ABCs are interconnected. Memory and metabolism, indicated by body fat, often go together, for example. Those with an APOE4 gene, a type linked to higher risk of Alzheimer's, respond differently to certain drugs and nutrients. I don't have it. So Isaacson bases recommendations for reducing risk on a patient's individual data picture, an approach called precision medicine. Up to 1/3 of dementia cases can be delayed or prevented by steps we already know, found in a 2017 Lancet report. But there's no single magic bullet, says Mary Butler, PhD of the Minnesota Evidence-Based Practice Center, whose recent reviews showed no single drug, supplement, exercise, or brain training program has been proven to do the trick. Scientists are also exploring drugs that could, like statins for heart disease, work preventively in high-risk patients. The body is complicated. The brain is complicated, says Isaacson. The roads to Alzheimer's are different in each individual. How worried should you be? Relief. My assessment reveals that most of my modifiable risk factors seem under control, with some room for improvement. I could still, of course, get Alzheimer's. Who knows what genes lurk undiscovered? And what if I'm among the 47 million Americans who, according to a new UCLA study, have no disease symptoms but already have neurodegeneration of or buildups of amyloid protein in their brains? Normally, this protein is routinely cleared away, but if that doesn't happen, it forms clumps that for some lead to Alzheimer's. Increasingly, researchers think any brain can become less efficient at clearing out the trash over time. It's impossible and too costly to scan every brain for amyloid right now. Luckily, what's already known about prevention is cheap and safe. Isaacson employs a tech team exploring digital ways to spread this info and more quickly train more doctors how to do assessments. Meanwhile, I'm really motivated to tweak what I can. A supplement skeptic, I'm giving omega-3s and my prescribed vitamins a trial run. Since tests show I'm an overabsorber of cholesterol, I've cut back on cheeses and switched my beloved whole milk vanilla Greek yogurt for non-fat plain with berries. It's still sweet. I haven't tried sitting on a balance ball while working, but at least I've located the muscles to strengthen my core. I'm determined to shrink my waistline to optimal size. My number one takeaway, the little things we do add up for our bodies and our brains, so why wait? To lower your risk, start here. Beating Alzheimer's is not one size fits all. Know your numbers. Get basic blood tests to find out your cholesterol, including HDL, LDL, triglyceride, blood glucose, and homocysteine. Learn your blood pressure. Hypertension in midlife is a key dementia risk, body mass index, and waist circumference. The good news, all our risk factors you can change if you're outside normal ranges. Any doctor can show you how. Take a cognitive test. It's useful to have a baseline of your current thinking skills to compare over time. There's no single best test, though it ideally should be less simplistic than the basic mini mental state exam used to screen for AD. Once you can try at home the 15-minute SAGE, S-A-G-E, test. For a link, go to AIZU.org. Or ALZU, I'm sorry, ALZU.org. Hang on to your muscle. We lose 1% of muscle mass a year if we don't do anything about it. A mix of aerobic and resistance and weight training helps burn the fat that leads to a more risky apple-shaped body. Maintain a healthy weight. There may be no such thing as fat but fit, recent studies say. Eat green and lean and clean. Almost every brain benefits from a plant-heavy diet, vegetables, beans, whole grains, nuts, seeds, with lean protein, fish especially, and low-fat dairy. Sourcing seems to matter. Grass-fed dairy and meat have less fat and more of it's healthy. The extra virgin olive oil for everything. Go fishing. It really is brain food. Fatty fish to eat twice a week include salmon, albacore tuna, mackerel, lake trout, and sardines. Some people benefit from omega-3 supplements and DHA and EPA. They're pricey and are best used under doctor's supervision. Pass on late night eating at least a few times a week. Try to hold out from after dinner until breakfast for 12 to 14 hours of no eating or at least no carbs. This helps your body burn stored fats. Put devices to bed. Sleep is likely as influential as diet and exercise researchers think. Hit the hay in time to get at least 8 hours sleep. Stop texting, checking email, and watching TV at least 30 to 45 minutes before bedtime. Balance stress with downtime. Every 4.5 years of work stress lead to one additional year of brain aging, Isaacson says. Yoga, acupuncture, and regular vacations all help. Keep busy and connected. Hobbies and friendships both relax and challenge the brain to learn new things. Social contact protects it. The word on brain games and crosswords is mixed. Remember, there's no one magic bullet. Visit the dentist and eye doctor. Surprise, untreated tooth and gum problems can cause problematic inflammation, and if you're having vision or hearing loss, treatment can spare you the resulting social isolation that is its own risk. Take up the ukulele. Don't smoke, but you know that. Consider genetic testing and join a clinical trial. Early intervention research is our best chance to cure the disease, says Harvard neurologist Risa Spierling. The first person cured of Alzheimer's disease will be in a clinical trial. Search for studies you might qualify for are at clinicaltrials.gov. So take action. Enrollment starts in June for the largest ever lifestyle study on preventing cognitive decline, the Alzheimer's Association-funded U.S. Pointer Study. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138. And stay healthy.